Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
Welcome to Life and Art from FT Weekend. I'm Lila Raptopoulos, and this is our Friday chat show. Today, we are talking about Civil War, the new film from director Alex Garland. When it starts, it's the near future. The U.S. is in turmoil and at war. A number of states have seceded. Kirsten Dunst is a veteran photojournalist, and she and her two war reporter colleagues are racing to get to the fascist third-term president before the White House is stormed by rebel factions. They're joined last minute by a rookie photojournalist played by Kaylee Spaney. And the three of them drive through a dangerous, destitute America from New York to Washington, D.C. It's part war movie, part disturbing road trip.
Every time I survived the war zone, I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are.
Well, you're American, okay?
Okay. What kind of American are you?
The movie, of course, is coming out in an election year in the U.S., and people have very strong feelings about it, both praise and criticism. And today we're going to talk about it. I am Lila, and I'm bumming a ride across America with the guy from Narcos, the guy from Dune, and the girl from Priscilla. Joining me in New York, representing the Florida Alliance, it's the U.S. executive producer of audio. He produces the News Briefing and this great show, among others. It's Topher Forges. Welcome, Topher.
Thanks, Lila.
Also from London, sitting on his farm, pretending this isn't happening, it's political columnist, film buff, and friend of the podcast, the great Stephen Bush. Hi, Stephen.
Hiya.
It's great to have both of you. Okay, let's just get into it. Big picture, what did you think? Did the film succeed? Did it fail? Stephen.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. I mean, I think, yeah, the thing that the film is trying to do is to depict the type of civil war, and indeed the type of conversations journalists covering that type of civil war have about what they're doing. But instead of setting it in the sort of place where that type of war happens and is covered all the time, but to set it in the imperial core, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. And to set it in the most recognized cinematic location ever. You know, so the opening sort of establishing bit of dialogue and establishes this road trip they're about to go on takes place in a hotel about 500 miles from the border, between various journalists talking about the passage of the conflict, which I thought was so reminiscent of the kind of conversation I've had or overheard in hotels in Zambia or South Africa about Zimbabwe. So I thought it was a fantastic war film that managed to succeed where very few war films do. Like, even Apocalypse Now is a brilliant, brilliant movie, but the war does actually look very cool. I thought it really succeeded in its aim of being harrowing, but the war was not cool.
Not cool. Yeah. Topher, what did you think?
Yeah, so I think as a piece of visual storytelling, it was incredibly successful. I saw it in a packed theater full of people, I think opening night, and everybody's locked in. You're just really engaged. You're not going to think about anything else. And I think I left after that experience, after I like took a deep breath, and everybody was like, I guess we'll continue our night now.
Right. Don't go on a date to this movie.
Yeah, America has fallen. Anyway, go get dinner.
Right.
I think after that, you know, I was really sort of perplexed and had to chew on it for a while. I didn't know how I felt. I think that it really subverted my expectations. And I think there was a period of me kind of having to get over what I thought it was going to be and meet it on its level. Mm. And in doing so, I felt like it was a really great depiction of kind of just American rage and just sort of a warning or a red flag of what could be the consequences if we continue to kind of eat one another.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with both of you. I really was ready to not like this film because I didn't really want to see a civil war in my country as I knew it. And in a weird way, it didn't do what I expected it to do, and it made me like it. Like, I felt that it did a really good job making it general enough that it didn't feel like a war that we exactly would be having in that, you know, for example, Texas and California, it's very unlikely that they will come together and secede from the rest of the country. But it was showing very up close images of, as you were saying, Stephen, the kinds of wars we know are going on around the world that we see in the news. But in personally for me, my home, you know, it's not set in Vietnam or Afghanistan or Somalia. It's set on a highway that I know with cars burned out in the middle of it. It's set at a sort of JCPenney in the suburbs. It's set at a refugee camp in Pennsylvania. It's sort of, for an American, you can't otherize anyone in that movie. I felt like we deserved to have to watch this.
Deserved. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a movie that provokes you. It is provocative, but it's not provocative in kind of like an edgelord or like I'm trying to be hardcore and show you something shocking, although there's shocking acts of violence. It's throwing a lot at you and then asking you to make sense of it and work backwards and process why things are the way they are. It's kind of purposely disorienting and like you don't always know who's on whose side or which team or which sort of military outfit is representative of what army. But it's throwing up all these things and asking you to kind of fill in the blanks and, yeah, try to sort of process what would be ultimately a very disorienting experience.
Yeah. I want to ask you both about the politics of the film. One big criticism is that Civil War lacks a political point of view. One critic called it evasively apolitical. Stephen, a lot of British critics hated the movie. I'm curious why you think that is. Like, what is it that people are reacting against when they're not liking that this movie isn't being sort of definitive in its politics?
So I think some of what people are reacting against is the trailer. And I don't know if that's a kind of deliberate bait and switch on the part of Garland to want to get an audience in one mood, so they are more effectively hit by the shock of it, or if that's someone at A24 going, we can't market this, just market it as a political thriller.
Right. We got to make money on this.
They make it very, like, hoorah action-y.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing is, right, it's perfectly legitimate for a film to market itself in a way which actually gets people to see it. So I think some of it's that, but I think the other thing about it is that because the president is quite obviously Trump-esque, particularly if you're a European. For some British film critics, you're like, oh, well, this is obviously a Trumpy president. Where's the rest of the kind of politics of this film gone?
Right.
Rather than being hit by the shock of the war.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think it's kind of a misnomer to say that it's apolitical for whoever says that. It just maybe isn't giving you the political conversation you want to have. Like, there are politics wedded into it. I mean, the film starts, I think, with intercut footage of January 6th and other riots. You know, he's trying to say something about the nature of the country today, about violence at large. But I think he's just not interested in filling in the blanks in a way that people were hoping that the movie would be about those blanks. And I think he's trying to say more about something about violence and obsession with violence and a way of using violence and hate as a means of control and sort of what it does to civil society and how it tears us apart. So I don't think it's apolitical. I just think, you know, people wanted a lot of dissenters wanted a very different movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's, that's exactly it in some ways, right? There is a very strongly political argument in the film, which is that it is a cautionary tale about why one shouldn't want to settle political disputes with violence, which obviously is salient because obviously in the last American presidential election, some representatives of one side did want to settle their political disputes with violence. And so he came up with the original idea, you know, watching all that on television in 2020. But you can tell that other influences and ideas and other conflicts have clearly influenced how he thinks. I mean, it opens with a necklace thing, which was famously one of the things which happened a lot in apartheid-era South Africa in the 1980s.
Right, that's a way that people were executed there, with rubber tires and gasoline around their necks.
Yeah, and there are aspects of it that, to me at least, felt very reminiscent of conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa and how they're talked about and covered and et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is the thing, is that what he's doing incredibly powerfully is depicting the way that, you know, often, particularly civil wars, you know, they start about one thing, and then even though in this film, to be honest, the war has been won, we're in that war's last days, there's still a lot of sort of just auxiliary violence that takes place in the margins of wars. And I think one of the reasons why the Texas and California alliance is a masterstroke is it's as close as you can get to the audience as turning around and going, for goodness sake, don't try and read a consistent politics into this film. Not least because the second you start asking questions about actually existing American politics, you would ask other questions like, well, surely the president's got the nuclear arsenal, and, you know, a bunch of other things, and would just break the conceit of the film.
Right, exactly. Okay, for our next section, I would love to talk about what you think this is about, big picture. I personally found this film hard to analyze fully zoomed out because it's pretty provocative and it has so many interpretations. But I found when I zoomed in, it was very poignant. Like, if you zoom in, it's about a lot of important things. It's about the fact that, like, wars are fought really close up between people, and actually people don't always know what it is that they're fighting for. They're just trying to kill the person who's trying to kill them. It's about how, you know, genocidal groupthink can happen pretty quickly. It's about the fact that, like, war is addictive. I mean, it's really about, like, the little moments of war. Stephen, what do you think?
I mean, in many ways, I think Alex Garland is an images filmmaker, and I don't mean that in a remotely derogatory way, in that with almost all of his films, the things that haunt you and rattle around your head afterwards are, so, you know, obviously, like most Londoners of a certain age, I think a lot about 28 Days Later because it was filmed in the parts of London where I grew up, and it, you know, depicts a very familiar seeming apocalypse if you're from that part of the world. I think what has kind of lived with me since this film is actually that I think you're exactly right. Say it's a film which most makes sense in its kind of small moments, right? Because it doesn't want to give you a bigger picture, but it does, right down to the very arresting final image that resolves on the screen as the credits roll. It's a film that really leaves you with how dehumanizing war is. Mm-hmm. Even this Trump-adjacent president who's held on to power in a third term, who's bombed his own civilians. His final moments are horrible. And I think also the thing that his final moments are doing is, and I don't think it's therefore the surprise that we all like, it is also a journalist's film. And the way that the president's final moments are so linked with all of the questions about, you know, are you just covering this story, or are you just by being there changing the story, shaping how it's covered? You know, there's so many questions there that it sort of, it raises but kind of doesn't answer, then sort of stay with you for a long time.
I do think you have to be okay with watching a movie that's not going to answer your questions if you're going to like this movie. I will say the thing that I bumped up against was probably the journalism part the most. I mean, I get it as a, you're following this group of journalists, it's a road trip movie, they're outside observers, and they're being able to, like, move into spaces that maybe the military wouldn't and have commentary on what this sort of destabilization looks like.
And that's why you would follow a journalist versus a military person through a movie like this.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, it ends on sort of a... Is it a, it's even hard to figure out. Is it ending on a cynical take? Is it like, how does he feel about journalists? And mm-hmm. it's a complicated picture, but I do feel like with the journalism part, it was especially asking a lot of questions that it just didn't have answers to.
Interesting. This is related to my last question, was just that, you know, because this is a film that can't help but rattle around in your brain, I'm curious where you landed and what it made you think about the most. It made me think about journalism the most too. And I actually felt sort of like, I felt like it gave me a view of journalism that felt more finished than the other things. I felt like, you know, even though these people were all individually flawed and some of them had big egos and they were, some of them were sort of addicted to war and totally traumatized, et cetera, they also still like believed in it, even though all trust in journalism had basically been eroded in America. Like they still, you know, believed in documenting, creating a record.
Did the Narcos guy believe in it? He didn't take a single note that whole movie. What is he doing? He's like, I got this for like, I have photographic memory. I'll get it for later. Don't worry.
Yeah, I don't know. He was there. That's enough. Yeah. At the stage, he was there.
He paid witness, but also told no one.
It did. You know, we had our foreign editor, Alec Russell, on Monday and to talk about like how to process the news when all the news feels bad. And he basically said that what gives him hope at the end of the day is that he does believe in justice. And he does believe that like over time, a record is accumulated and people do, you know, justice can happen. And I felt that that movie sort of believed in that, too. I found that slightly hopeful.
Well, I think it's odd because what I liked about it, and I agree that it is a broadly hopeful film about what journalists do. But I think what I particularly liked about it is it does successfully capture that there is just inevitably a lot of ambiguity. Particularly, there's a lot of ambiguity when you are reporting on a conflict of any kind and you're embedded right within mm-hmm. the battle. Now, of course, the slightly strange thing about it is that in many ways it is like a kind of pre-Vietnam War depiction of war reporters. Yeah, one Joel, as Dostoevsky says, doesn't appear to make a single note. so it's clearly in that old New Yorker long read era of, and then he said right. something incredibly eloquent that no one can check if he said it or not. Yeah, there are hardly right. any actually other mounted cameras in there, but I think it does capture all of the ambiguities and the personal conflicts and challenges within them while being a hopeful movie in many ways about that bit. And so, yeah, I think it is a very profound film about journalism as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a real movie. It wasn't a remake, a new script. We had a lot to say about it. I think in that way it did a job. So Topher and Stephen, thank you so much. We will be back in just a minute for More or Less.
Picture this. You're at a dinner party and you've confused the Mag 7 for 007. You can't remember your bulls from your bears, and somebody talking about their liquid portfolio makes you wish you had a liquid lunch. I'm Claire Barrett, the FT's consumer editor, and in my new 5-minute investor mini-series, I'm on a mission to break down financial jargon with experts to make you a better investor, all in the time it takes to make a cup of coffee. Catch the 5-minute investor coming soon to Money Clinic.
Welcome back for More or Less, the part of the show where each guest says something they want to see more of or less of culturally. Topher, what do you got?
So last night I watched Hitchcock's North by Northwest, and mm-hmm. that movie famously ends on the top of Mount Rushmore. And it just made me think we need to have more movies that end in their third act in surprising landmarks. We're using the same landmarks. It's getting old. We saw Godzilla Suplex Kong on a pyramid this year. I'm over it. And so if you're a studio and you're not sure what you want to do, but you know you want to end on an unusual landmark, I found one that keeps your options open.
Okay.
It is Casey, Illinois, and it is home to 12 of the world's largest objects. You got the world's largest rocking chair, mailbox, gavel, wind chime. Have King Kong hit Godzilla with the world's largest gavel. Let's be a little less lazy, studio executives.
Topher, you've come prepared.
Did my homework.
It was the perfect
This
more
is my
or less.
Passion.
Wow. Stephen, what about you?
My less is I would like less Ghostbusters. In fact, having, and I have no one to blame for myself because it's not like I was forced to see Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, but having seen Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, I think the ideal number of future Ghostbusters films would be zero. And so, yeah, less Ghostbusters, please.
Any quick reason why?
I think because basically it's like, it sums up what's wrong with that kind of nostalgia market. And then you have what's clearly a filmmaker's promising and perfectly charming young adult fiction turned into an original movie starring Dan Aykroyd, living alongside, you know, kind of almost like someone's used Ghostbusters nostalgia as polyfiller. And the resulting film makes no sense. It was just a bit tawdry and depressing, really.
Yeah. Okay, no more Ghostbusters. I have a less two. I'm going to say fewer. Fewer menus at restaurants. I went last weekend to a restaurant in Jersey City that was an old Italian couple's house. It was called 15 Fox Place. And you just sit there and eat for 2.5 hours. They bring things out. And it was really a delight. And it reminded me of restaurants in Copenhagen that did the same thing, although they were much trendier. You just showed up and they fed you. And I think more restaurants should do it. Just like sit you down. Don't let you see a tasting menu. Don't let you see a menu at all. And bring me on a journey. I don't want to choose.
Nothing tastes better than not having to choose.
Exactly.
Someone just bringing you food.
Stephen Tover, this is about as much fun as I could have talking about an American Civil War. Thank you both for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That's the show. Thank you for listening to Life and Art from FT Weekend. Take a read through the show notes. We have links expanding on everything mentioned today, including the FT's review of Civil War by Danny Lee, who did not like it as much as we did. Every link that goes to the FT gets you past the paywall. Also in the show notes is a link to buy tickets to the US FT Weekend Festival in Washington, D.C. It's coming up. It's on Saturday, May 4th at the Reach at the Kennedy Center. I will be there hosting panels. A lot of friends of the podcast will be there. A lot of big name guests will be there, like Marilyn Robinson, who's incredible, Bradley Whitford, Nancy Pelosi. And we hope to see you there. We have a special discount code for podcast listeners in the show notes. I'm Lila Raptopoulos, and here's my talented team. Katya Kumkova is our senior producer. Lulu Smith is our producer. Our sound engineers are Breen Turner and Sam Javinko, with original music by Metaphor Music. Topher Forges is our executive producer, and our global head of audio is Cheryl Brumley. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll find each other again on Monday.